It's the Painless Living Show with host and pain treatment expert, Dr. Michael Cassero, and co-host, John Ashton. If you or someone you love suffers from chronic pain, get answers here. Call now, 888-440-4442. That's 888-440-4442. Or visit online, painlesslivingshow.com.
Don't despair if you didn't get a chance to write that number down. We will repeat it once or twice, sir, ad infinitum, for the remainder of this hour. Good morning.
Yes, it is. It's a very good morning.
Glorious morning. I'm John Ashton. He's Dr. Michael Cassero, and he is here. In case you're thinking, no, it's not such a great morning for me because I hurt. And that's not good. When you've got trying to live with pain, it can be a real pain to live with pain. You know?
That might be why they call it pain.
Let's research that. Arm pain is the topic on this side of the radio this morning. On your side, whatever pain you may feel you need to address, it's all open. 888-440-4442 is the phone number. But if you want to talk about arm pain, doctor, you've got, your three basic components, right? You got your hand, you got your elbow, and you got your shoulder.
Well, you got a forearm and an upper arm in there
also. Can you count fingers in there too?
Sure, I guess you got fingers.
Are there afflictions that can affect your fingers and not your whole hand, or is it fingers just part of the hand?
That case, the fingers are part of the hand. Okay. Yeah, there are some things, but most of the chronic things that we would be talking about today would affect not just the finger, but the palm adjacent to it, maybe even the wrist.
Yeah. This just popped into my head. Maybe a stupid question. I don't know. But just answer it. Don't tell me if it's stupid. do nerve problems happen most often at joints?
That's I wasn't expecting that kind of question. No, I wouldn't say that's a stupid question. That's a good question. Let's put it this way. One of the things that aggravates nerves a lot is when they get stretched.
Okay.
And joints are where nerves are most likely to be stretched.
Okay.
Where you're bending a joint too far and it stretches the nerve around the joint, or where you dislocate a joint and the nerve gets pulled in a direction that it's not meant to go and gets kind of stretched that way. So from that standpoint, there are a lot of ailments that you can get that seem to be worse around nerves. But I wouldn't say overall, when you look at all the things that can happen to nerves, it's kind of spread all up and down the nerve, even in between the joints. The
reason I ask is you've got some pretty complicated joint situations going from your hand to your shoulder.
Oh, yeah. Well, the shoulder itself. I mean, that's the most mobile joint in the whole body.
Yeah, it's a marvel of engineering.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, come up with an engineered joint that does what the shoulder would do.
Yeah. Yeah. You should make that a final exam in engineering school. You think anybody could handle that?
Well, they might be able to, but I'm not sure I'd want that to be my shoulder.
Exactly. Exactly.
How durable would it be?
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's start down at the bottom with the hand. Again, substantial potential situations that can lead to pain in your hand, everywhere from arthritis from a previous injury to carpal tunnel to ligament injuries or tendons or even cysts. I mean, there's numerous potential maladies down there.
Yeah, there are, and some of those are pretty common, too. Like, we talk about cysts. Well, ganglion cysts would be one of the most common ones. Those happen a lot.
Really? Are those little things you feel?
A little bump.
Yeah.
Okay. A little knot. They usually don't hurt. When they do, it's usually because they're putting pressure on something. But they're common. People get them all the time. And
they come and they go, don't they?
They can.
Okay.
Usually when they go, it's because they've gotten ruptured somehow. Mm-hmm. You slammed your hand in a door or something, and now that cyst is gone.
You have bigger problems.
Well, not necessarily, especially if you're fairly young. It's likely not to cause any additional problems. In fact, the age-old cure for a ganglion cyst, long before there were doctors with board certification to cut them out, was to have someone put their hand flat on the table and then to take the heaviest object you could find, which was usually the family Bible, and smack it as hard as you could. And that would pop it like a water balloon.
I can imagine.
And cure
lead,
it.
And lead to many other complications.
Well, depending upon the malice involved. But that was considered a cure for ganglion cysts. And it, guess what?
It
works.
Yeah. Yeah. So, is arthritis probably the most common cause of hand pain?
Well, it is, but part of the reason for that is that arthritis is the grab bag term that everything else fits into, including the ganglion cysts that we just talked about.
Okay.
They usually come from a joint.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've got those, you've got cartilage damage, you've got ligament or tendon damage, either one, and all those can result in what we call arthritis.
Okay. When you have a stiffness, and a lot of us, maybe it's, you know, a lot of us think it's just a symptom of getting a little older. But sometimes when you haven't used your hand for a while, especially waking up first thing in the morning or something like that, there's a bit of a stiffness in your hands. But you do this a few times, you know, just move your hands, flex your fist, et cetera, and everything works again, as it should. Is something causing that, or is it just, hey, I'm old?
Well, the something that's causing it to work again is just stretching and moving. And we've talked about this before. If you look at your pets, the first thing your dog does or your cat, either one, when they awaken is they stretch. And that's a good thing for people to do, too. As far as why it gets that way to begin with, it could be a circulation problem. More commonly, it's a nerve compression problem, something that happens in your sleep when you're in one position for too long, especially when that position compromises your nerve function or your circulation.
Okay. So don't worry, basically. Stretch.
Yeah, stretching is good.
Yeah.
And you talk about people with arthritis, they'll tell you the hardest thing they do in the morning is get up out of bed. But once they get up and they kind of get everything stretched out and reoriented to the world, they're fine the rest of the day.
Yeah. So is that typical, or is that something that a different type of sleeping surfers could fix?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Depends.
It's the you know, the dichotomy here when you talk about sleeping surfaces is people think about soft mattresses, things that you sink into, soft pillows, that's where comfort comes. And that's really, you know, the epitome.
Right.
The problem is when you look at ailments, that's kind of where the ailments come from too. Sleeping on a hard surface is probably better for you in the long run as far as avoiding those ailments. And some of that might just be what we were designed for. I don't think that the Neanderthals had mattresses and pillows.
No, actually, and there wasn't a whole lot of soft space in those caves.
Yeah, I imagine that right up until farming, when they could start filling mattress or filling bags with mowed grass or something else, leaves, that most people slept on the ground or on straw mats or something, and pretty
so
hard.
Get it harder. Sleep on the floor for a while. The hand, the elbow, the shoulder, arm pain, the overriding topic of discussion. 888-440-4442. You've got some questions, got some situations, give us a call. Going to take a quick break and be right back.
To learn more about the topics or products mentioned on the program, visit our website, painlessslivingradio.com.
Get a question into Dr. Cassaro during today's show, you need to call 888-440-4442. Or, of course, you go to painlesslivingshow.com. That is a website, and there is a contact button there if you prefer to ask a question more anonymously or at least less publicly, and send an email directly to Dr. Cassaro to explain whatever information you can include, and we'll go from there. We got one of those that fits the topic for today I wanted to talk to you about. It says, Doctor, my fingers go white and hurt whenever they get cold. This has been happening for years, and it seems to be getting worse the past 2 or 3 years. It never bothers me in the summer unless I hold a cold drink or reach into a cooler of ice, but now it sometimes bothers me in an air-conditioned room. I don't feel cold anywhere else, just my hands. They call it Raynaud's disease. When I Google that, well, it has me really worried. The pain and numbness make it impossible to button or unbutton my clothes. I can't grasp a zipper, and I forget about picking up paper or coins. Over the past 2 years, I've tried 3 different medications. They all help a little bit, but the problem seems to be getting worse still. The last doctor I went to, well, he wants to cut out my top ribs. He told me about bad things that could happen and couldn't guarantee that it would cure me. I'm looking for some middle ground. Can't blame you. Something better than the ineffective medicine that doesn't involve carving. Help me, doctor.
I want the middle ground. Kind of a lot of territory there.
Indeed. This could be a show in and of itself.
Yeah, Raynaud's disease is something that I think gets overdiagnosed. I mean, there is a real condition, Raynaud's disease, or it's actually more appropriately called Raynaud's syndrome. But I think a lot of times it just gets, it's a diagnosis that's made too quick without looking for, you know, what other things could be happening. The fact that it's on both hands, it may really be Raynaud's disease. I know some people that just get it on one hand or the other. And if that's the case, more likely it has to do with nerve problem, usually pinched at the neck or the elbow. The thing about the hands getting cold or hands turning white when they get cold, a lot of people think it's a circulatory problem. It's not really a circulatory problem. It's just that those blood vessels clamp down so hard that no blood flow goes through. But it's because the nerve is telling the blood vessels to squeeze down tightly. So you don't get blood through there. That's why the fingers turn white.
Gotcha.
And that's why they start to hurt. So the way to fix that is to look at the nerve. Now, there's a lot of medicines that people use because they do tend to help a little bit. Most of them are things that are predominantly used for blood pressure control because they dilate blood vessels. So you try it for the Raynaud's disease, and it may help a little bit, dilate those up. They don't turn white as easy, but it doesn't really do too much for the feeling. Okay. People still have numbness and pain. So anyway, that's what the Raynaud's syndrome is. It can be caused by a variety of things, but that's the point, is you have to look to see what's causing it. Now, I don't know, did this person have an MRI on their shoulders or neck that showed that there's compression of the nerves by the first rib? If so, that might be the best recommendation. But most of the people that I see with what's called Raynaud's disease, it's actually something else, especially, you know, if this person had had it his whole life, you know, maybe that's what it is. But if it's just been coming on for a few years, then I'd say it's probably due to something else changing inside his body. And it can be a variety of things. Diabetes can be something changing the nerves so that now they're more susceptible. Thyroid disease is another one that can, and there's all kinds of metabolic problems that can do it. A lot of times you see people that are constantly dieting, they run into nutritional problems, and they start developing odd symptoms, and this could be one of the odd symptoms that they see. So you really kind of have to take a close look at what's causing it, And then if it's not because of ribs putting pressure on the nerves, mm-hmm. he can find that middle ground he's looking for.
And it may be a good idea for him to start looking for middle ground immediately, if not sooner.
Yeah.
I would just go say, hey, do an MRI. Show me why you want to cut these out. Or do doctors not appreciate that?
Well, I think probably, yeah, part of it is that doctors don't appreciate that. But a part of that is also that he said it doesn't really bother him in the summertime, which mm-hmm. is typical.
Yeah.
So that means from about May to November, he's not even thinking about it, let alone seeing a doctor.
Right. Right.
And then from November to March, he's thinking, it's going to go away. And then he finally, his wife convinces him to go to the doctor in April, and then it's gone again the next month.
So we won't worry about it. You might want to look at some beachfront property in Belize. Just saying.
You know, maybe I shouldn't stereotype too much. But.
an associated question, though. When you have had prior situations where you got too cold, I'm not saying frostbite, that's a little too serious, but, you know, just this side of a frostbite situation on your extremities. I have found in, you know, growing up in New England and stuff, that for a while at least, you are much more susceptible to cold after that.
Oh, yeah. I think you don't even have to grow up in New England. I grew up in Florida.
Okay.
And it was the same thing. Well, not a lot, but those 2 days a decade that it does.
Yeah.
No, our hands would get numb too.
Yeah.
And then when we moved to Kentucky, we found out what hand numbness really is. I could imagine in New England, that's all child's play to you.
Oh, don't leave home without the mittens.
Yeah, once those hands get numb, especially when you get to the point where as they warm up, they are really painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for a period of weeks to months afterwards, you are more susceptible to the cold.
Is that because you've done some serious nerve damage, or why is that?
No, I don't know that there's been any permanent damage done at all. But what's happened is you've increased the irritability of that nerve. The cold, just any time when the nerve is at a lower temperature, mm-hmm. it's more irritable.
Okay.
So just that increased the irritability of the nerve. And then the fact that it got to that point where the recovery was prolonged and mm-hmm. hurt, I think that irritability lingers.
Yeah.
But then it goes away. It eventually recovers again.
Just a case of your nerves not trusting you to make it stop soon. And they start getting cold. They can't guarantee that you're going to be smart enough to come in out of the cold.
I could imagine that if you think back to eons ago when our ancestors were wandering around in the woods,
mm-hmm.
that first cold snap would be the message to tell them to hunker down for the winter.
Time to go to sleep.
Yeah, and that would be a way of accomplishing that, is to make the nervous system a little more irritable so that they get a little bit more protective.
Yeah. I have a question a friend of mine wanted you to ask. This is I'm asking for a friend.
Sure.
Do you have to play tennis in order to get tennis elbow?
Well, no. In fact, the people that play it well usually don't get tennis elbow. No, the answer is you don't have to play tennis to get tennis elbow. I'm not sure the exact history on how it got named, but I'm sure it was an affliction that was identified in tennis mm-hmm. players, so they called it that, but it can happen to anybody. In fact, these days, I'm convinced that the number one cause for tennis elbow is not tennis at all, but it's the plastic grocery bags that you can carry with your arms hanging straight down. And that's mm-hmm. what causes the tennis elbow.
Really?
Before the plastic grocery bags,
mm-hmm.
you had to cradle the paper bags in your arm to carry them.
Yeah.
And nobody had tennis elbow from carrying grocery bags.
Okay.
With the advent of the plastic bags, you could carry 3 or 4 in each hand,
mm-hmm.
hands hanging down straight, all the nerves stretched all the way from your shoulder down to your fingers, mm-hmm. and you develop tennis elbow. But that's actually more from a tendon being stretched. So one of the things to do is to loop those plastic grocery bags around your forearm
mm-hmm.
and cradle them in front of you.
And then just worry about them cutting off the circulation before you can get to where you're going.
Yeah, but that'll recover faster than the tennis elbow.
That's true. And you don't need a brace or a sling or any pains for the circulation situation.
No, but there's a lot of things that can cause tennis elbow. Mm-hmm. And basically what it is it's a strain on the tendon there that pulls where it attaches to the bone.
Okay. So how do you take care of something like that?
The easy way is to start off with just oral over-the-counter medications. You could also the anti-inflammatory medicines. Mm-hmm. You could also use one of those elastic elbow support braces. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there are some topical medications that include the anti-inflammatory medicines that you can put on to soak right into the muscle.
Okay. Sounds good. 888-440-4442. That is the phone number here. If you have any questions of any sort, give us a call. We'll be right back after a quick break.
It's the Painless Living Show. To be part of the program, call now. 1-888-440-4442.
888-440-4442. Arm pain, anywhere from the fingertips to the top of the shoulder. That's what our topic is. But the doctor will entertain any pain situation you might have whatsoever. It doesn't have to be within the topic of our discussion. At 888-440-4442. Do we have one yet?
And we do have a caller on the line. This is Norman calling from Jeffersontown, Kentucky. Norman, you're on the air at the Painless Living Show. How can I help you this morning?
Yeah, good morning, doctor. Your topic today was arms and hands.
Yes.
Something strange happened to me, and it's only happened twice in my life, but it happened to me a couple of weeks ago. My left hand started to grow numb from the base up, and it went through the little finger, the second finger, the third finger. I think it almost pretty near stopped before it got to the first finger. And then just remained that way for maybe 15 minutes. I was trying to flex the hand and rub it and whatnot, and didn't do any good. But all later, after about 15 minutes, it just receded the way it had come up and went away. And it was totally numb throughout that time. I could have hit my hand hard on something and it wouldn't have felt anything.
Okay, when you said that this has only happened to you twice in your life, when was the first time?
Oh, I don't know, a year or so ago.
Okay, so it's not something that's seems to be a beginning of a pattern.
No, and I do have the white fingertips like your previous guest said, but I think I'm just by nature cold.
Well, the thing that I'd look at, is it always the same hand?
On the white fingertip?
Yes.
I don't recall. I think it was on the left, though.
Okay. Well, the thing that I would look at is, first of all, there's probably something changing in you to bring this on. But more likely, you've got some irritation of either nerve or blood vessel that's causing the blood flow to reduce. And I think it's probably primarily a nerve problem, and the only thing I base that on is you saying that it was completely numb throughout the whole event.
Yeah.
That would more likely occur if the primary problem was pressure on a nerve, because if the primary problem was a blood vessel, it wouldn't get numb until very late. It would have to be decreased blood flow for a while before it would start getting numb.
And I started with a chiropractor, and she said there's some problems in the cervical area. That might be what they call a subluxation on that would extend down to the arm, just like a sciatic nerve would extend down to the foot.
That's right. Yeah, and that's a likely source. I wouldn't say it's the only source. You said that it began in your fifth finger, your pinky finger?
Yeah.
And then moved across?
Well, not
so,
just the fingers. It was mostly in the whole hand.
The whole hand. It could be a nerve at your elbow that's pinched there or has bone spur there, something putting pressure on the nerve at the elbow.
30 years ago, I crashed on that elbow, and the doctor called it that I would have olecranon bursitis.
Okay.
But that's never bothered me. It all healed up very well.
What you might have is a little bit of that still lingering, a little bit of problem from your neck, and then maybe a little bit of some other neuropathy or something contributing. And when they all get to some critical point adding together, that's when you have one of these episodes where your hand turns white and goes numb.
Yeah, I was just curious. It didn't bother me. I mean, I could live with it fine.
Well, as long as you didn't get your hand caught in something while it was numb.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, a few weeks ago, I called you about the MSM bath along with Epsom.
Oh, yes.
And I forget exactly what you said. Just a half of a cup of MSM and half of a cup of Epsom salts in the bath water, because that seems very weak a solution.
Well, the MSM, you don't need as much because it's a little more concentrated. If you're using the crystals, about a half a cup of the crystals in a bathtub of water is fine.
And with a cup of magnesium sulfate.
Yeah, say when I say a cup, probably more than a standard coffee cup size, a large cup.
Right.
I wasn't necessarily talking about an 8-ounce or a 6-ounce cup, but the way that I usually illustrate to people is if you cup both hands together, that's kind of what you want to do, is scoop down and get 2 cupped hands full of Epsom salts. So that's probably more like 8 to 10 ounces volume-wise rather than a standard coffee cup size. And then you throw that in the bath water for a standard-sized bathtub.
Right.
And it's not going to be real concentrated. No, it won't be highly concentrated, but it'll be plenty of magnesium and MSM to do the job. The problem with the Epsom salts, if you put a lot more in the water, you'll get more magnesium, but it can also leave your skin very dry. So there's a trade-off somewhere. Now, if you want to put lotion on afterwards, that might balance it out a little bit, but I'm not sure that the extra magnesium on a one-shot deal is that beneficial over using it more dilute on a more regular basis.
And is there any danger of magnesium to a kidney process? Because I only have one kidney.
Not if you're doing it that way. If you get really concentrated, it could just overwhelm your ability of the kidney to filter it all out quickly. But it's not toxic to the kidney in any circumstance.
Especially at that lower rate of concentration.
No, not toxic at all.
Well, thanks a lot, Doctor. You're very helpful.
Okay. Good luck to you, Norman. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling.
And thanks, Norman. Again, it's 888-440-4442 if you have any questions or opportunities to participate here. Arm pain, the discussion, hand, elbow, and let's touch on, if you find the expression, the shoulder. Because something about the hand and the elbow, when they hurt, you can kind of, you know, not touch things with them. You can, what's the word I'm looking for?
Protect them.
You can protect them. The shoulder, you're always touching something with. Whether you're sitting, you're laying down, whatever, it's kind of difficult to
try putting on a jacket, let alone a t-shirt.
Well, you never know exactly how much you use any particular joint or muscle in your body until it hurts when you use it. And then it's like, whoa, all the time I do this. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of movements that your shoulder is not a participant in.
It is the most mobile joint in the body when you look at the range of motion that it's supposed to go through. And one of the ways of keeping the shoulder healthy is to keep it moving.
Okay.
One of the things that I see a lot is people with what's called a frozen shoulder. Now, that's not just one thing, but people get a frozen shoulder usually because they don't raise their arm up except to use a fork or a comb. And then so the day comes when they have to get that thing off the top shelf that they stuck up there when they moved into the house 10 years ago. And the arm won't go up there the way that it did when
they put it up there.
Put it up there.
Yeah.
And that's just because if you don't keep the joint moving, it loses its ability to move through that full range.
Are there a regimen, or is there a regimen of exercises that you would recommend someone do? Not you know, not go to the gym exercise. I'm talking your simple get up in the morning, do this just to try to keep. I mean, you've already mentioned the stretching thing when you get up, but
that's really all it takes is a good stretching routine when you get up. You know, you get up, you kind of reach your arms out, you stretch, maybe clasp them up above your head and reach back a little bit, maybe behind your back. And then you do the same thing with legs and hips. Now that I said that, though, you're not reaching behind your back, but you're stretching.
Gotcha.
Yeah, you just kind of do like your dog does. I mean, look at the dog or the cat, either one.
Right.
They stretch pretty much every part of their body, and then they just prance away.
They walk off.
And it's a good thing for people to do the same thing when you get up in the morning, but for some reason, people tend not to do it. Kids do it.
Yeah.
You look at kids when they wake up. They do it.
Yeah.
We unlearn it as we get older.
Yeah. What's up with that? I don't understand.
I don't know. I did the same thing. I had to relearn it.
Yeah. Because just after you mentioned that, many an occasion where you're sitting, I mean, that was a routine. You sit up, you go, and then you get out of bed, and there you go. Don't do that anymore. I kind of tumble out of bed now and hope that the knees don't hurt too bad when I try to stand up straight. You know what it's like.
And hope that there's not a Lego on the floor.
Yeah, definitely. Shoulder separations and dislocations, are they different?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you actually have two joints at your shoulder where your arm meets your body. Mm-hmm. There's the big joint, the ball and socket joint that has all the mobility, and that's the shoulder joint. And then up on top of your shoulder, there's two bones that come together. One is your collarbone, and the other is your shoulder blade. And they kind of meet on the top of your shoulder, and you can feel a little notch there where they meet.
Yes, you can.
And that's another joint.
Okay.
We just call that the AC joint, because the acromion is the part of the shoulder blade, and the clavicle is your collarbone.
Right.
So AC joint is easier to say and remember. So when you get a shoulder separation, you're talking about the AC joint, that joint on top, where those bones just pull apart, and that's why they call it a separation.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about a dislocation, you're talking about the ball comes out of the socket.
Okay.
The big joint, the shoulder joint.
Do you have to experience some serious sort of trauma in order for those two things to happen, a dislocation or a separation?
Separation, not necessarily. Okay. Dislocation, yes.
Okay. So how about some shoulder injuries you don't have to be an athlete to sustain? 888-440-4442. You got any questions whatsoever, give us a holler, because we're going to take a quick break and be right back.
It's like an office visit without the copay. The Painless Living Show.
888-440-4442 is the phone number. So if you've been contemplating making a phone call, we've got just over 10 minutes yet together this morning. So you should do it now.
Yeah, this is the last segment of the show.
That's right.
So call in now, please.
888-440-4442. We had gotten from the hand through the elbow up to the shoulder. And we have any phone calls at the moment?
No.
Okay.
No, the lines are open.
The lines are open. Come on in.
So the opportunity is yours.
We had mentioned just a couple of, you know, potentially serious stuff, a separation, dislocation. Are there really serious situations that a pain in your shoulder can be a sign of?
Sure. Yeah. You know, shoulder trauma is so easy to get.
Right.
And if you've got something that persists, whatever the injury is, if it's persisting past 2 weeks, you should already start thinking that maybe you've got a significant injury there. Certainly past 6 weeks, I think it's probably a good idea to get it checked out. Now, are there things that can eventually heal on their own without the aid of a doctor, just with you taking care of yourself? Sure, most of it. But if you've got something serious in there, like a common thing would be a torn rotator cuff, and you keep re-tearing it as it's trying to heal, you can end up with a chronic problem there that will never get better unless it has a serious intervention.
Mm-hmm.
On the other
hand, surgical intervention, maybe?
A surgical intervention gotcha, involving okay. sharp instruments
and needles.
You know, the worst part about that surgery isn't the surgery, it's the rehabilitation.
Yeah.
So if you've got a rotator cuff tear, even if it's near total tear, but you take proper care of it initially, get good treatment early on,
right,
that may heal on its own. The problems all come from the re-injury and continuing to re-injure it.
And patience is a virtue, but not one that's celebrated by many people, especially when you're recuperating from something like that. You know, you figure, well, it doesn't hurt, so I'm just going to go. You know, they told me to keep it immobile for 2 weeks, but it's been 3 days. It doesn't hurt. I'm fine now.
You know, another one that becomes serious is, we were talking before the break about dislocations.
Right.
People that get one dislocation are much more likely to get another dislocation than people that have never had a dislocation to begin with. And people can get chronic dislocations. And that gets to be a serious problem, because once that's repaired, even with an excellent surgical outcome and excellent rehabilitation, your shoulder function is not going to be what it used to be.
Okay.
So now, one of the things that's changed recently in the last decade or so is introduction of shoulder replacement surgery. Very similar to hip replacement or knee replacement surgery. And the results of that are frequently a lot better than the results before that technology came around. But still, if you don't have a catastrophic injury to begin with, you want to be able to avoid getting to that point.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's a serious commitment right there. What is bursitis? I keep seeing this. It's, you know, something that your grandmother used to talk about, along with rheumatism.
Well,
but that was just an excuse to take medicine.
Yeah, that's, well, the rheumatist medicine was kept in the counter there with the shot glasses.
Yes, the one that had the lock on it when I was there, yeah.
Well, bursitis, first of all, means inflammation of the bursa. Whenever you see itis at the end of a word, a medical word anyway, that's inflammation.
Okay.
And the bursa is a sac. That's all it is a sac. Now, every joint in your body has a sac around it that holds the joint fluid that keeps the joint lubricated.
Okay, okay.
So when that sac gets inflamed, you've got bursitis. And that usually makes that joint very sore.
Just your lubrication situation is reduced, right?
Your lubrication is now filled with inflammation mediated angry cells.
And another thing, I just want to point this out, because I was wondering when I saw this commercial for a diagnosis that I had never heard mentioned on TV vis-a-vis by this drug, but I had heard it here, and I may not even be pronouncing it correctly, but it's ankylosing spondylitis.
That's the right way to say it.
Okay, but they say it once in the commercial and then say, or AS as we refer to it. What is it, and why is it really something they just found out they've got a medicine for, or is it something that they have medicines for everything else? They figure, well, finally we'll get to this now.
Well, if they're advertising it on TV, it's because they're selling something.
Okay.
So my guess is they just invented a medicine for it. The thing I can say about that that's good is that at least the condition existed before the medicine. There are other situations where they come up with a medicine and then go out and invent a disease so that they can advertise that it cures that disease. So at least they did it the right way, the proper order of things with this. Ankylosing spondylitis is more of a condition of the spine, but it can affect any joint, and it's where joints just get scarred down to each other where they don't, they're not mobile anymore. The bones actually start to fuse together as if you had a fracture that healed. Only there was no fracture there. The bones are just healing together. The calcium, the bone material is actually growing together.
Oh, okay. That sounds like
not a good thing.
Sounds like it would be difficult to treat with just medication.
Well, it's kind of the ultimate frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
Is where you can't move the shoulder any. You want to move your shoulder, you got to lean your whole body to one side or the other.
Right. So when you have a pain, at what point do you say, seek medical treatment?
Well, long before you get to that point.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of completing the, or adding more information to ankylosing spondylitis, that's an autoimmune condition.
Okay.
And that's usually not the first symptom of that condition. So it's been going on for a while before you get to that point.
Gotcha. And you've got multiple sclerosis, MS, on your list, too, which is also an autoimmune condition, isn't
sure.
it?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of people run into trouble using their hands when they have multiple sclerosis. They can't write properly anymore, sometimes can't write at all. They lose coordination, kind of like the emailer that we had earlier. Mm-hmm. They can't pick up paper, can't turn pages, things like that.
Right.
And it might start in their hands with those symptoms, and it still be the autoimmune condition in the nervous system.
Right. Now, is that the only thing? I mean, because a lot of people have, like our caller today, has a temporary situation where, you know, for a while you may have a weakness in your grip, not be able to get it, and then it goes away, comes back and forth like that. Is that like the onset of a immune system's autoimmune situation,
you know,
or what?
There's probably a few things going on, and just to speculate here, I think he said he had a neck problem that he was seeing a chiropractor for.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably has the nerve not compressed, but, you know, pretty tight in the opening where it comes out to go to his arm.
Gotcha.
And then along comes something like allergy season, maybe causes a little bit of inflammation in his body.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's actually getting the flu or something. Add to that maybe a little change in medications that alter the balance in his body. And now that tight nerve is compressed just enough where it starts to cause that symptom.
Yeah.
But if he gets a chiropractic adjustment, it loosens it up. Because we're talking about the straw that broke the camel's back. We're not mm-hmm. talking about that being the whole cause.
Right. So again, we're into the confusing situation of referred pain, referred situations, where a problem in your hand could be a problem in your neck. You just don't know it. Because you're thinking, hey, my hand is what hurts. Let's look at my hand.
Well, the other thing, he also had an elbow problem.
Mm-hmm.
And people that have hand problems that start with their pinky finger and involve loss of grip strength and things, a lot of times that's coming from that nerve at the elbow that we mistakenly refer to as the funny bone.
Well, I was going to bring that up because those symptoms are exactly what happens when you hit your funny bone.
Sure.
It doesn't last long, but it's what happens.
Yeah, and it's because the funny bone is really a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And when you injure that nerve, you feel it wherever that nerve goes. That's why you get that shock all the way down to your hand.
Yeah. I don't know which would be worse. Get the shock that comes on and then slowly dissipates, or one that slowly comes on and then slowly dissipates?
I don't know. Either way.
The anticipation would not be fun. Are there over-the-counter medications that people can take? Is it your basic, you know, ibuprofens and anti-inflammatory stuff and just your arthritic creams and things like that, or what?
For most of what we've talked about today, yes. Okay. The over-the-counter anti-inflammatory medicines are a great place to start.
Mm-hmm.
There's also some topical creams. Things we talked about, the anti-inflammatory creams, mm-hmm. but also things like capsaicin, which is pepper cream.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of variations of that on the market. And for arthritis, they do a great job of desensitizing the pain in those joints.
You know, you can get a lot of tidbits throughout the course of a week just by following Dr. Cassaro on Twitter. And that address, sir, would be, do you remember?
Yes, at Painless Living.
All right. And also, you can follow the doctor on Facebook page.
Painless Living Radio Show.
Or at his very own website, painlessliving.com. Again, if you have any questions you want the doctor to answer for you, now that our time together today is done, you can always just go to painlessliving.com, hit the contact button, and send a question via email. Other than that, we'll be back next week.
I'm your host, Dr. Michael Cassaro.
And I'm John Ashton, co-host. We look forward to seeing you back here next Saturday morning. Have a painless week.